Greetings, everybody. This is John Loeffler. Welcome to Lifetime Income. And today's Lifetime Income is an encore presentation of a program we heard earlier in the year.
The Financial Sense Lifetime Income Program. Now, here's the Financial Sense News Team, Jim Poplava and John Loeffler.
Hi, everyone. I'm Jim Poplava, and welcome to this week's edition of Lifetime Income.
And I'm John Loeffler. Today, we're going to talk about real estate. You know, for most Americans, their home represents their largest asset. And fortunately for people who are into homes, real estate prices have been rising. They're almost back to where they were at the peak. But 2017 has marked the turning point in home ownership. Household formations are outpacing renters for the first time since 2006. So now we have a question that we must ask. Are we in a real estate bubble? What does the real estate market look like? And if you happen to be getting ready to retire and your major asset is your home, you really want to pay attention to today's program. So that's the groundwork and the landscape, Jim. Jump in.
All right. Well, every month there's a Case-Shiller index, which tracks real estate prices, 20 major cities. They have a 20-city index, a 10-city, and a national index. And then they also track real estate prices by different cities. The national index came out this week. It is finally above the peak in 2008. Their 20-city index is at 193. It's very close to its peak in 2008. And the 10-city is also close to a peak. But what I found is rather interesting, John, is it's almost like a bifurcated market. If you want to say real estate is in a bubble, it depends on where you're looking at. And there were several cities across the country that are really in bubble territory. We're not going to go through every one of them. If you just Google Case-Shiller Index, you can take a look at the city if you want to know where your city is. But a couple of cities stand out: Denver, Dallas, San Diego, San Francisco. A lot of these cities are at levels way exceeding where they were at the peak of the real estate bubble. And as we did a show on real estate last week with Kathy Fetke, I mean, she said basically, if you take a look at real estate prices in the San Francisco Bay Area, they're just absolutely insane. Same thing with the LA Basin. So the Case-Shiller Index is up 5.8% year over year. That's a national level where they take a look at the major cities. And housing prices are up nearly 40% from hitting a bottom in the housing crash. So, I mean, the good news, if you're a consumer or you're heading near retirement, a lot of you that may have been upside down on your mortgage going back to 2008, you're finally in the black. You've regained what you've lost. And in many cases, depending on where you live, your house is worth more than it's ever been worth. And in some areas, especially like San Francisco, Dallas, Miami, some areas that have been really hot, we have a housing market that is really on fire.
And that's why the San Diego Fire Department is overworked with all those houses on fire.
Well, I don't know about that. But.
Well, anyway, I guess if we are at that kind of a sort of a frenzy, Jim, are we back to the level that we were prior to the 2007 crash, you know, when you had this buying frenzy going on?
Really, the dynamics of this housing recovery are a lot different. Number one, there are few signs or imminent signs that we're anywhere close to a housing bust. I mean, if you look at lending by banks today as a result of Dodd-Frank, banks are putting in place tougher lending standards. I mean, you don't have ninja liar loans and the crazy stuff that we were doing in the housing bubble years in the last decade. They're requiring larger down payments from buyers. The exception being Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, which is run by government. Banks are looking at higher credit scores, but there are some areas that are starting to look frothy. I mentioned a couple of those cities, Denver, Dallas, a lot of the cities, major cities in California, Miami, and other areas of the country. But you're starting to see some things that are looking a little frothy. For example, licensed real estate brokers are up 25% Since the bottom of 2012, real estate brokers or people moving into this profession are at 9-year highs, just slightly below the peak in 2006. But what makes this real estate recovery a little bit different after what lenders went through and builders went through in the housing crisis, this is really driven by lack of demand. Builders aren't building mass projects or building a lot of spec homes. They've been very circumspect in the amount of homes they're building. We have a couple new subdivisions near where we live. And unlike when I wrote The Day After Tomorrow, where builders were just, you know, one phase after another on speculation because they knew they could sell them. Right now, builders are saying, all right, we're starting phase one. We're not even going to start phase two until everything is sold out in phase one. The phases are smaller. They're not building as many homes. So a lot of this has to do with lack of supply. Now, part of that has been caution on builders. And number two, it's taking a much longer period of time as a result of environmental restrictions to get anything approved. I mean, there was a well-known environmental attorney in California that would always fight these projects until his children had difficulty being able to afford a home. He's now flipped and is working for the builders to get these things. It takes, sometimes as much as a year to 2 years to get permits to be able to build. And that's restricting supply along with caution on the half of builders. So whether this is a frothy market, you really have to go to some of the cities. And if you go to the Case-Shiller Index, they have most of the major cities in the country. And you can look at a graph, and some of these cities are just gone bonkers, Dallas being one of them. So I wouldn't say it's frothy yet, but we are beginning to see signs of froth. The one thing that I think you'll not see if housing prices soften as a result of prices going up, like, for example, 6% year over year and rising mortgage rates, which will make it more difficult to qualify, I think you're more likely to see a softening in the market than you will a bust, as we saw, for example, between 2008 and, let's say, 2010, when things just collapsed. But the more important thing here in why we're discussing this is the median average American's net worth consists almost entirely in the equity in their home. And so if you are 5 or 10 years away from retirement and your major asset is your home equity, this is a very important show to listen to because we're going to talk about some alternatives that could have some major impact on your retirement.
You know, a classic scenario would be that people nearing retirement at one time may have had a big home, but now the kids are grown, the dog's gone, and you don't need quite the space that you needed before.
Where'd the dog go?
Well, the dog died.
Okay.
I didn't want to say that, but the dog died. Okay, so the dog's gone. The kids are gone. They're off to college. Although my kids are always boomeranging, no matter what age, it seems like, one way or another. And, you know, this house was their major asset, and they don't need it that large, you know?
We're going to talk about several options, and one of the biggest options that is available, especially when you have a considerable amount of equity tied up into your home, unlike, as we have talked about here so often, unlike our parents, defined benefit pension plans where you work for a company and you get 70-80% of your salary as a pension when you retire, those plans are gone by the wayside. What we have is defined contribution plans, and it's basically whatever you put in the 401k or the company pension plan, whatever that amount is, that's what you get for retirement. There is no guaranteed income. The only place you can get those, really, it's with government. And John, I predict as we get into the next decade, defined benefit pension plans are going to go the way of the dodo bird with a defined benefit for government, because governments will not be able to sustain these defined pension plans because it's going to bankrupt cities. It's already doing that, whether it's Detroit or cities in California. They just can't maintain the pension payments and promises made to these retirees. There isn't the tax revenues to support that. But anyway, as a result of the changing landscape in pensions, John, the only predictable thing left is Social Security. And I hate to tell you, folks, in the next president, whether it's Donald Trump's second term or another president, we are going to have to address entitlement reform because it's unsustainable. Social Security and Medicare are going to go broke. So if you look at the one predictable source of pension income right now, for most Americans, it's Social Security if you work in the private sector. The second asset or the major asset of most Americans is the equity in their home. So I want to talk about six options, and they all have their uses depending on your circumstances. One is sell and downsize. You sell the big family home, you downsize to a smaller home. Number two, you sell and relocate. So maybe you're in one of those expensive areas in this country, like Denver, San Francisco, LA, Miami, Dallas. You sell your house and you move to either another part of the state where homes are cheaper, or you move to another state where the cost of living and taxes and everything else is cheaper. So that's option number two. Three is maybe you were one of those homeowners that bought a home in the last decade and you were upside down and you had a high mortgage rate that you were stuck with. Now that housing prices have come back, you might want to consider refinancing. And this is going to be very effective if you're 5 or 10 years away from retirement. The other thing, and this is something new that's come up and it's innovative, it's Airbnb. I have several clients right now that live in paid for homes that rent out their homes as a source of income. I had one client that last month, they took in $2,000. We had a lot of conventions here in San Diego and they rented out their home. A fifth option is reverse mortgage. And I'll tell you where that really makes a lot of sense. And number six is HELOCs or home equity loans as a source of additional capital. And this is most effective if you have a lot of equity in your home and you don't want to spend down your assets during a bear market where you might draw on the equity in your home and use that rather than spend down your assets. So those are basically six choices. But for a lot of Americans, a considerable amount of their net worth resides in the equity in their home. And that's why if you're getting ready to retire, you really have to think about some of these important decisions. And you have some options here.
Let's go back over those options and sort of indicate when they might be appropriate. What sort of triggering events would you use to be able to pick an option here?
Well, let's begin with option number one, sell and downsize. Okay, let's say you had two kids, you had a house, you had a 2,500, 3,000 square foot house. You don't need that in retirement. The kids have grown up, and as John says, your dog has died. Well, you know, maybe it's time to downsize and take some of that equity out to do two things. Number one, you can take that equity, downsize, and pay cash for a home so you no longer have a mortgage payment. Or you can take some of that and buy a home and have some money left over and turn it into revenue producing income as part of your portfolio. This is probably the most likely choice that makes a lot of sense for a lot of people heading into retirement. I mean, really, if you had a 3,000 square foot home, 4,000 square foot home, whatever it was, the kids have all grown up. Do you really need to have all that equity tied into a single asset called your home that doesn't produce income? And that's one of the things that you want to do when you retire. You are looking for as many assets that can produce income other than, let's say, your Social Security, or if you're fortunate enough to have a pension from a company. The second option where this really can work out well, let's say you live in an expensive area of the country, California being probably one of the most expensive, or maybe you live in some high-priced areas like Dallas or Denver, Miami, some of these really hot markets that are rather frothy. What you might want to do, and this can be very favorable, say, for example, you live in California, you live in San Francisco or the LA Basin area where real estate prices have just gone nuts. I mean, literally, homes are selling for over $1,000 a square foot in some of these areas. you sell, and then you move to an area that's more affordable. You move to Arizona, you move maybe to Nevada or some places in the South where the cost of living is cheaper, or the tax rates. California has the highest tax rates in the country. We have very high sales taxes in the 9 to 10% range. We have high property taxes in the 2% range, 1 to 2%. And then on top of that, we have income taxes of 13.3%. So a lot of the clients, just as our guest last week, Kathy Fetke, she works with people helping them to relocate to cheaper areas of the country to live. So not only are you downsizing, but you're also going to move to an area of the country or another state where the cost of living is much, much cheaper. And that includes housing, income taxes. How would you like to move to a state where you pay no state income taxes, where the average person here in California pays 9.3%? So number two is sell and relocate. Maybe you're going to move closer to where your kids are working. Although I would caution you not to make that your sole reason for moving to another state, because we know that people don't stay in the same job forever. You can work for a company, even if you have a lifetime career, they could transfer you to other places in the country or the world for that matter, or your kids can change occupations or jobs. So sell and relocate is number two. Three is refinance. Now this can come in handy if you are, I don't know, 5-10 years away from retirement, now that real estate prices have come back up, maybe you're no longer upside down on your mortgage. You know, even though rates have gone up, we're still looking at the cheapest interest rates that we have in almost 5,000 years. So an option would be to refinance your home and maybe lower your payments, use the savings that you get from, let's say, lowering your house payment, and use that to start building up a personal investment portfolio. So refinance is another area that would be very popular as a way of saving some money. Or you could be retired and maybe you're stuck with a high mortgage. Folks, if you haven't done it by now, I highly recommend that you do it, because we are going to be climbing an upward swing towards higher interest rates over the next decades.
This Airbnb concept is really interesting. It's innovative. It's always interesting how free markets work. Somebody always comes up with an idea. Sometimes it's an idea to end run things government has done. Sometimes it's to make money. But very much like Uber to taxis, it's a new trend in the hotel industry for people, especially, say, in places where the taxation on the hotel industry is high for people who need some living places.
Yeah, there are a lot of people that basically are saying, look, my house is free and clear. I don't want to sell it. I live in an area where I have all my friends, you know, my country club's here, the people, my network, my social network is right where I live now. I don't want to move. I don't want to make a transition and go someplace. Another way you can earn income is Airbnb, where you actually rent out. Let's say you have that four-bedroom home and you're only using one bedroom. I have a client that has a paid-for home here in California. They have kids that live here, fortunately for them. They, last month, they were telling me they made over $2,000 from Airbnb. We have a lot of conventions around this time of the year, and especially during the summer. And basically, they said, hey, we just go stay with our kids, and they're glad to have us because we babysit the grandchildren and give them a break. But they've turned their home into sort of a source of rental income. And this is very effective if you are living in your home and you have a lot of equity, maybe it's paid for, and you're looking for an additional source of income. This is really, really taken off. In fact, Bill Gates was just interviewed, and he said it's one of his favorite concepts. It's a disruptor to the hotel industry, because governments and hotels have been raising fees, and the cost of, you know, going to conventions or business conferences have gotten very expensive with all the fees. You know, they quote you one rate for the hotel. What they forget to quote is what all the taxes are, or the resort fees, the parking fees, all those other things that add up. A lot of people are just choosing, hey, you know what? If I can live in some person's home and their bedroom, all I need is a place to take a shower in the morning and a place to sleep at night. It's much, much cheaper. So Airbnb is turning out to be a viable option.
One thing I'd like to talk about is reverse mortgages. There are commercials all the time for them on at least the cable channels. I'm not sure about the main networks.
Well, I mean, that is an option. It is not one of my favorite. Basically, what you're doing is you're turning the equity into your home into a mortgage payment. In other words, the mortgage company pays you, and that debt and those interest payments will add up. And then when you pass on, whatever balance there is, it may go completely to the reverse mortgage company. There may be sometimes money left over. But basically, you're turning your house into a sort of a rental stream. The bank is paying you on your equity. You have to be age 62 to qualify. It also can be used, depending on your circumstances, to bridge the gap to higher Social Security payments. In other words, if, let's say, full retirement age is 66, we know that if you delay receiving Social Security to age 70 and a half, your Social Security payments will go up by 32%. So for some couples, it can be a very effective tool to get a higher pension income out of Social Security. Another effective use of, let's say, a reverse mortgage is when one spouse gets old and, let's say, develops dementia, Alzheimer's, and has to go into a long-term care facility. What you're doing now is you're maintaining two households. You're maintaining the household of the well spouse, and then now you have additional payments and burden of the spouse that's ill that has to be maintained. And in those cases, that's where a reverse mortgage can provide the extra income that can help defray some of the cost of long-term care. Those are my favorite uses of reverse mortgages. You use them as a life preserver because I don't like them as a general strategy. There's a lot of ancillary fees and costs. A lot of these fees and terms, loan interest can vary from lenders. So you really have to shop this market to get the best returns. And many people take out loans too soon and they deplete their home equity early on in retirement, leaving them unable to pay their annual property taxes and insurance. So it's something, John, I would recommend that you use as a last resort. Use it in combination of Social Security planning to maximize your Social Security benefits, or you use it to take care of long-term care costs with one spouse becoming sick and requiring constant care where you're maintaining two households. Other than that, it's not one of my favorite options.
Let's pose a situation which I think will probably affect a lot of people. You're going to sell and then downsize, and in addition to that, you're going to move to another location, notably another state. That's where people tend to go because it's cheaper to live there. You get rid of a lot of taxes if you're in a high tax state. And overall, the cost of living is much lower. Any words of either advice or caution in doing that?
Yeah, there's one piece of advice if you are considering this, and I strongly make this recommendation. Rent the first couple of years because, number one, you move to another state, you don't know yet whether you're going to like living there. Maybe the weather gets to you, you don't like it. It doesn't have the cultural values. Maybe you don't have the same medical facilities. And number two, you really don't know the area. You don't know the best part of town to live. You don't know where the values are. Because, you know, if you go to another state, you hire a realtor, their job is to going to try to sell you a home. Well, you may be better off renting to decide whether you really like living in this state, whether you like the weather, the amenities, and all the social fabric that you would want to bring into your life. And secondly, and this also works well when you start moving to an area. I had a client that had two of their children move to the state of Texas. One worked in the petroleum industry, one worked in real estate, and they basically moved there because they wanted to be close to their kids. Plus, you know, the idea that Texas didn't have any income taxes from California, they saved some money on taxes. But, you know, the son that was in the petroleum industry, he worked for a large international company, he got transferred overseas with his family. So a lot of times you'll move to an area, just remember, your kids may not always be there. Their husband or spouse may get transferred to another area. Then now what do? You move there to be close to the kids. Now you have your house. Do you want to really relocate again? So I recommend that if you're going to relocate to another state, whether to be closer to family or just because it's cheaper to live, you can buy a house cheaper, your taxes are lower, the cost of living is cheaper, I would strongly advise that you really rent the first couple of years until you get your bearing, get your feel around town to really understand that, hey, I really like this place. This is where I'm going to spend the rest of my life. So basically, John, I would recommend renting if you're going to relocate to another state. I've seen too many mistakes made where the people don't like living there, their kids move, or they buy a house and they overpay because they're not real familiar with the area.
And Jim, the final option in this whole process, home equity loans. We didn't cover that.
You know, I only use them where they come in handy if you have some temporary medical expenses, or let's say you have a portfolio and you're on a drawdown rate of 4%. You're mainly invested in ETFs and mutual funds. Well, you do not want to be drawing out 4% when the market's down 40%. So what you do is you get maybe a temporary home equity loan to supplement your living expenses, and you draw that down temporarily, because what you don't want to be doing is selling off your assets when stocks and bond prices are going down as dramatically as they did, like, for example, 2007 and 2009, or 2000 to 2002. I mean, from 2007 to 2009, the S&P lost 58% of its value. Do you really want to be liquidating shares when the market's down close to 6%? You have that happen at the beginning of your retirement, it'll set you back the remainder of your life. Kind of think of that, once again, as a spare tire in the same way you would a reverse mortgage. You only use it in extreme circumstances where that's probably the only viable option you have.
Okay, I want to remind everybody, too, that tomorrow on the program, Paul Horn from PFS Group is going to be here. Tax planning for corporate executives will be the subject of conversation. Let's see if we can summarize this up before we go into our real-life case study here. If your major asset is a home, and say you're 5 or 10 years out from retirement, here's what you can do. Number one, you could sell and downsize. You're going to save money on mortgage payments between hither and yon the time you retire. Number two, you could sell and relocate and save a lot of money. And number three, you can refinance, which we've done a couple of times. We also sold and relocated, Jim, as a matter of fact, to a much cheaper place to live. Four, you can turn your home into an hotel with an Airbnb and bring in revenue. You can do all those other things too. Well, you can't sell and relocate with an Airbnb. Five, you could do a reverse mortgage. And six, HELOCs, where you take a temporary loan, an equity loan on your house to get you through a bear market till everything turns around again. And then you continue the same payment procedures that you were doing before. Okay, it's time for our real life case study, which is based on the lives of real people, cases we've handled. And we changed the names to protect the privacy of the people involved. And there are charts available on our website to illustrate the principles that Jim's talking about. And of course, this is rotating around the whole issue of real estate. Are we close to another bubble, and should you sell?
No, it's actually shopping for executive compensation.
I like that. That's big Bucksville.
This week, we have the case of Kevin and Lacey Yang. Kevin is age 55. Lacey's age 52. The current plan is to retire within 8 to 10 years. Kevin would be close to full retirement age. His full retirement age would be age 67. Likewise with Lacey. Given their life expectancy, longevity really runs in this family. Kevin's life expectancy is 91. Lacey is 92. Their risk tolerance is moderate. Investment objectives, growth with preservation of capital. So let's get into a little bit of color of who Kevin and Lacey are. Kevin is a software engineer. He's worked as a software engineer for the same company for many years. He's mainly worked in the city, but is considering swapping careers and moving to a more rural area away from the fast-moving city life. He's always managed the family's investments. He's currently concerned about their concentrated company stock positions. He's very risk-averse, especially when you're considering retiring in 8 to 10 years. At this point, given that he and his wife lost a lot in 2008, that had a major impact on them. Their goal was to retire at age 60. They're not going to be able to do that because of what happened to them during the downturn, so they don't want to go through that again, given that they would like to retire in 8 to 10 years. They're kind of ready to settle down. He likes the prospect of retirement, wants to buy rural land away from the city where he can spend his time farming and hunting, which are hobbies of his. Lacey, on the other hand, is vice president of finance for a large corporate finance company. She loves her job, enjoys working in the downtown city area, kind of a little bit different than Kevin. Lacey is anxious about their current tax situation given their high incomes and especially their executive benefits. She's mostly relied on her husband to manage the finances, but is worried about their exposure to the market, does not want to go through basically what they did in 2008. They have concentrated stock positions as a result of both their employment. Lacey is looking forward to retiring, but wants to maintain the same lifestyle that they had in living in the city. What was interesting about this is we had them take a risk questionnaire, and on a scale of 1 to 10, 1 being the least risky, 10 the most, is very typical of what we find most people retired. Their risk profile is much different than the way their money's managed. Their risk score was 3 on a scale of 10, moderate risk. Their portfolio was up at the top with a risk score of 8, big downside potential. So there was good reason why they were both worried. Most of it had to do with their concentrated positions with the company stock that they both work for, the different companies. Their basic important goals in the plan was mitigating taxes because they were subject to AMT, asset allocation. They wanted to make sure that they were properly prepared for retirement. Their budget, essential budget, $125,000, discretionary, mainly a lot of travel, $57,000, $182,000 budget. Lacey's salary, $315,000. She was the main breadwinner. Kevin's salary, $120,000. They had surplus income of over $250,000 a year. Kevin figured if they went out and bought rural land, lived outside the city, they could live less expensively. They would still want to continue to travel. Essential budget would drop down to $110,000 from $125,000, about $15,000 drop. And discretionary would drop down to $42,000, so basically almost $150,000. Lacey's Social Security would be $33,000. Kevin's Social Security would be $31,000. Their shortfall would be close to $90,000 a year. Now let's take a look at their assets. Their primary residence was worth $2.3 million with an outstanding mortgage of roughly, I'll round this off, close to $300,000. Lacey's retirement plan was $1,120,000. Kevin's retirement plan was $850,000. They had taxable accounts of $350,000, and they had cash of $500,000 just sitting in basically savings, and then they had executive stock options worth about $600,000. So the large cash position had to do with they were big savers and they didn't see anything that they really wanted to invest. And especially with the stock market going up, setting records, they really didn't want to go in the stock market because of their fears of what happened to them in the 2007-2008 downturn. Some of the things that we had to look at was mitigating taxes on their stock options, managing investment risk associated with the concentrated stock position. Both had different retirement goals, and they wanted to create a reliable source of retirement income. We basically put the majority of their account into what we call a balanced account between stocks and bonds, about a 60-30 split at this time, and that will probably go down to 60-40 and 60 and 50-50 the closer we get into this bull market towards its end. That produced 3.1% income. That would produce roughly investment income of $92,000 a year. Their income would be about $160,000. They would have a surplus of about $8,000. What we did to minimize their tax strategies, Kevin and Lacey both have mixtures of what we call ISO, NSOs, and RSUs, which we'll talk about on tomorrow's program with Paul Horn. Since they are subject to AMT tax, we advise the client to make a disqualifying disposition on a portion of their ISOs to raise ordinary income taxes and remove them from alternative minimum tax, which is a tax preference item. On some options, there's something called an 83B election, which was chosen to take advantage of long-term capital gains rate on the growth of the stock. We also encourage them to downsize their current city home because it was considerable given where they would want to buy, given that they want to go to another state. They were taking a look at some of the areas they were looking at was Washington, no state income taxes, Nevada, up in the Tahoe-Reno area, no income taxes, Arizona, which has low income taxes, and Texas, no income taxes. So they were looking at that, and we said, look, if you're getting close to retirement, you know what real estate prices are in California. You know, this is a good time to sell and maybe downsize here, given the fact that you're going to want to move to another area when you retire. With their retirement stock options, their right stock offerings, we had Kevin and Lacey treat them as cash bonus, and we elect to sell them as soon as they were vested. This strategy reduced their stock exposure while the cash was used to help cover taxes and the rest was diversified into other investments. Maintaining the same retirement lifestyle had to do with continuing working because they had to. I mean, the original goal was to retire at age 60. The last market downturn has forced them to work until age 65. And basically, we wanted to manage their financial plan and stock options. And we want to have them. I said, look, if you're going to retire and you're looking at three or four other states, why not take a vacation? If you want to go to Seattle, start looking at places you might want to go and visit. Likewise, if you're thinking of Nevada because of no income taxes, they didn't like Vegas that much, but they like Northern California because Kevin grew up in San Francisco. So, you know, it's a couple hour drive from San Francisco Bay Area. So we said, you know, why don't you start taking vacations, start looking in these areas and start prospecting and saying, hey, would I like to live here? Because they definitely wanted to move to a lower tax state. And so, John, right now we're in the pre-retirement phase. They're looking at the option of putting their house up for sale. And this year, their first vacation is they are going up to the Lake Tahoe area. And they're going to check around Nevada, Reno, Nevada, and the Tahoe area as a possible place to relocate once they retire. In the meantime, we're out of time. On behalf of John Loeffler and myself, we'd like to thank you for joining us here on Lifetime Income. Until you and I talk again, we hope you have a pleasant week.
You can subscribe to Financial Sense NewsHour in the iTunes and BlackBerry podcast libraries or at feeds.feedburner.com/FSM. Find more information about our guests at www.financialsense.com/newshour. Friend us at www.facebook.com/financialsenseonline. For our on-the-go listeners, you can access Financial Sense on your mobile device at m.financialsense.com. The Financial Sense NewsHour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the NewsHour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of James Poplava and do not take into account listeners' suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense NewsHour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies profiled on or advertising with Financial Sense or arising out of the use of any material on the NewsHour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.
Today's Lifetime Income program was an encore presentation of a previous Lifetime Income show heard earlier this year. Next week, we'll be back on our normal broadcast schedule.